Are you ready, Alabama?
Shurmur picks it up on third down, fakes the throw, goes to the end zone, stretches, and he got it! Touchdown, Vanderbilt!
It's time to enter the doghouse.
Play action for Bryant, who's going to take a downfield shot. McCloud is wide open, collects it, and they will not catch him. Just like that, the Tigers stretch the lead, 79 yards.
Call 866-485-9867 to get your bark on.
Third and one. Hit that ball on a hit well, and Mixon's going to walk in. Oh, what a night for Fitzgerald.
No time to get on the phone? Tweet the big dog at Tom Abraham Show.
Darnold in trouble. Darnold jump pass. Down at the 30.
Allinger with time. Allinger flushed out. Throws.
Touchdown, Texas. Foreman. Wow.
From the Tennessee Valley.
In trouble in the backfield. Wants to throw now. He's going to go deep. And I mean deep. And I mean touchdown, Florida.
Here he is. The head of the household.
A Hail Mary that's full of grace for the Gators.
The big dog.
Rams blitzing. Hurts gets it away in time. First down complete to Foster. Putting his legs to work. The turbo in. Touchdown.
Tom Abraham. Now, it's Reaction Monday. In the doghouse.
When you come to our house, we show you how to play some SEC ball. It don't matter where you're from. You're going to know what ball we play. Alabama, you're next.
No, you see, you don't do that. You don't do that, Alabama, you're next. Welcome back, Tom Abraham Show, and joining us now to kick off hour number two. Guy does a tremendous job for CBS Sports Radio, and of course, the host of Sunday Morning Football as well on CBS Sports Radio Coast to Coast, Damon Amendler. D.A., welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks, big dog. Yeah, it doesn't usually end well when you taunt Alabama and your Vanderbilt.
Yeah, well, the thing is that, you know, Vandy, what a great win over K-State. I kind of predicted it. For the last several weeks I've been saying, look out, Vandy plays great defense. K-State comes in there to get whacked, and they came in number 18 in the country. And I thought that, you know, now Vandy would have something for Alabama. It would be a tight game. I was appalled when I saw the line opened up. It was like 19 points. I'm like, wow, Vandy's way better than that defensively. And then that kid has to say something like that. Why, if Vanderbilt, aren't they smart there? Why would you even say so? How is that not the ringtone for every kid this week at Alabama?
Yeah, I would imagine that at Vandy you don't have a ton of opportunities to crow because you're usually getting your head beat in by the rest of the SEC. So when you get one of those wins, you really want to, I guess, take advantage of it. But yeah. I would imagine that Nick Saban is going to properly utilize that for this week's preparation.
Yeah, I would think that might be in the game plan. I'm not sure. He won't say that, of course. They never say that. I mean, they have these press conferences. They're always going to say, you know, that we respect the opponent and that's it, and they're never going to say any of that stuff. Part of the narrative in college football, Mark Schlabaugh wrote this, at ESPN, and it was ESPN.com, and it's the SEC is a shell of its former self, you know, which benefits Alabama. That was the headline. And there seems to be this concept about that, you know, the SEC is down in a big way, and I get where it's coming from. But do you see – I don't see any of these conferences having multiple really good teams. It's reflected in the rankings where the top five teams are from five different conferences. And I don't see any one conference that isn't very, very top-heavy right now. Do you?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could make the argument that the Big 12, because it has
– two teams, though.
Obviously. Oklahoma and Oklahoma State might be the closest thing towards that, but I don't think either one of those teams, I don't think both of those teams, rather, are going to go to the college football playoff. So I don't think any of these conferences have two components in there that could get to the college football playoff. And look, the SEC is easy fodder for people to hate on it because of all the dominance that they had for the decade. But, yeah, I mean, when you look at, like, the power teams around college football, it seems like, as you just mentioned, all these power conferences have one elite team and then everybody else is kind of scrambling behind that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they talk about the Big Ten and I understand and I love the Big Ten. Right now, Penn State's the highest ranked team in the Big Ten. Ohio State, you know, took a pretty good knock from Oklahoma. Michigan, you know, they're 3-0. They fell a spot in the rankings. They're not looking, to me, Michigan's not looking nearly as dominant as you would think. You know, some of these other teams in the middle of the conference getting knocked around. Clemson is great in the ACC. The next ranked team is, what, Florida State? They've lost their quarterback. You know, Louisville looks like they're not really all of that. They're quarterback talent, and that's it. And I get what you're saying about the 12 with Oklahoma and Oklahoma State. But after that, the rest of the conference, really nothing. I mean, TCU had a decent win against Arkansas, but we don't know if they're any good. It just USC struggled to beat Texas as a 16-point favorite. You know, I don't think there's any real great conference out there for anybody to get all excited about. Wow, the SEC now sucks. It doesn't suck. It's just pretty much like everybody else.
Yeah, I think it's just so super early to make any type of declarations on conferences. And, I mean, I would imagine that as we make our way through the season, there are two great teams. I think those two great teams are going to be Alabama and Clemson yet again. And I think maybe they'll be victims of their own success in terms of being so much better than their opponents that it'll seem like there's no other good teams. But, you know, it's Oklahoma. I mean, that's a wonderful win, obviously, that they got a couple of weeks ago. But do we think that on a neutral field they can topple Clemson or Alabama? Perhaps. Maybe you would put them in the conversation. But I think if you put those in the top three, I would feel like there's a real valley between those three and then the Oklahoma States or the USC's of the world. So I kind of wonder if it's just not just those three teams are so elite that it makes everybody else kind of seem more mediocre.
Yeah, it does feel that way. There's no question about it. Damon Amendolara with us here, talking a little college football to get things started off and getting into some NFL football as well. And now week two is in the hopper, and, you know, everybody in New England can breathe a sigh of relief as the Patriots came back with a vengeance the way they played against New Orleans. And you like to feel like Kansas City, like in my rankings, I had moved Kansas City to the – well, I actually had Green Bay at the top of the heap. They'll fall. Kansas City, I had number two. But the thing with Kansas City is it's just so hard to buy into an Andy Reid team long-term, isn't it? I mean, don't you get the feeling that they're like the Texas A&M of the NFL? You know, they're going to get out to a 9-0 start or 8-1 or something like that, and then something will happen late, and then they'll get bounced in the first round of the playoffs. It's just so hard to get excited about Andy Reid teams for the long haul.
Yes, it is, and I talked about it on my show earlier today the same way, is that they are probably right now, if they're not the best team in the NFL, they have the best resume in the NFL with those two wins, and they obviously look very dangerous, but they've gone 11-5 two out of the last 4 years. They've gone 13-3 or 12-4 rather last year. Andy Reid has not been worse than 9-7 in Kansas City in his 4 years at the helm. He has been absolutely fantastic since he got to KC, but they can't get past the divisional round of the playoffs. So does this feel different? Well, it feels a little different because Alex Smith has actually taken shots downfield. But when you lose a guy like Eric Berry, that's a big blow to the defense. And this is a team that could be 12-4 and a two seed like they were last year. And it would be hard to really totally buy in that they would be able to do damage in the playoffs. So unfortunately, they made their own bed. It's a team that's been great in the regular season, but iffy in the postseason. And I don't know how you kind of overcome that until you start doing it in the postseason.
Yeah, no, they have to do it. And that's why, you know, you look at teams that build their way to the postseason. And as we talked about the Patriots last week, there have been other years where they struggled to get out of the chute. And then they're rolling the last 4 or 5 weeks of the season and into the playoff. And that's how you win, you know, the Super Bowl. It just seems to be that way. Now, having said that, there are some other teams that seem to be, you know, Atlanta seems to be a pretty good football team. And I know Green Bay has struggled in that building before, well, not in that building, but in that city before. But, you know, Atlanta, Oakland seems to be like the real deal. There are a few teams, Denver, you know, maybe Trevor Siemian is a quarterback. You know what I mean? They you know, they just thrash the Cowboys. So you start to kind of put together a little bit of a narrative here.
I really like Trevor Siemian. I think that that Broncos team was vastly underrated coming into the season. I think it was a little unfair because last year Trevor Siemian played pretty well in the first 3 months of the season, then got dinged up, and then the Broncos didn't finish well. But I think it was a little unfair not to consider them as real legit Super Bowl contenders coming into the season because people just didn't know Trevor Siemian enough. And I think because he's not flashy or wasn't a high draft pick, people assumed – that he wasn't good enough. Well, he was pretty good last year, and now this year he's been excellent. And you still have to remember that defense is so good, and they have three very, very good skill position weapons on the offense with Demaryius Thomas, Emmanuel Sanders, and C.J. Anderson. I think they were so underrated coming into the season. I had them at number six in my overall power poll of the NFL going into the season, and they look really good, and I just had a feeling you would see, and I liked what I saw from Simeon in the preseason. I just thought that you would see a better Broncos team than people gave them credit for, and I think we're seeing that now. They've got to make sure that offensive line holds together because this injury on the offensive line, their draft pick, is a big one, but in the AFC, I really think the Broncos have the guts to rattle some cages and be one of the best teams of the AFC all year.
In a division that is outstanding. I mean, the Chiefs, we just talked about them, and the Raiders, you know, off to a 2-0 start and you know, a nice win on the road in Tennessee where they've won 3 years in a row. And then they go home and just kind of take care of business, very workmanlike, put that thrashing on the New York Jets, who are just horrific. They're the worst team in the NFL probably. But then you look at Marshawn Lynch and two things on him. First of all, your thoughts on his game and your thoughts on his in-game dancing.
You know, I thought it was funny. I don't know. I feel like sometimes we've sucked the life and the fun out of this league too much. And the Jets are all bothered by it and upset by it. But I liked his moves. I mean, it was a little weird. It was a little bit like headbanging combined with some moshing, with some hip hop. But, you know, I'm okay with that fusion of a dance move. What I'm not okay with is the Jets, you know, being one of the worst teams in football, stripping this thing down to the bare bones, then getting whacked and saying, oh, stop dancing on us. You know, well, you're the ones losing by 30 points every week. What do you want people to do?
Well, I know Jack Del Rio likes
it. I was actually very inspired. I was going to go join him. But I thought it was best if I just stayed back and continued to coach. But it got me fired up. You can see the pure passion that he has. I mean, these are his people. These are my people. We played well.
Yeah, and I think he was reacting to the fans dancing on the screen. That was the thing when Marshawn Lynch was dancing. It was like he was kind of dancing with all of those people and the fans and so on. And this is what continues to make this even more painful, that this team is leaving that black hole after all of the bad years, that they seem to be having such a blast there. And they are his people. I mean, he's from Oakland. And it just seems to be such a good vibe there, and that this is going to get ripped away from them is very painful. And I'm just, I don't know what the answer is, but I'm hoping people are taking a close look at what's going on in Los Angeles as they make this move, because I'm afraid that it could end up similar to that at some point in time in Vegas, and that's going to suck for the NFL.
Agreed. I mean, this is that quick money grab, that land rush, that going towards the shiny object, instead of really taking the long approach. And I think the long approach was doing everything that they could to get a stadium done in both Oakland and San Diego, and especially in San Diego based on what we've seen in Los Angeles. But I'm with you. I am pained by the fact that the Raiders finally got good, and now they're looking at the ticking clock of potentially losing that team in 3 years. But my only solution for the Raiders is they've got to win a Super Bowl over the next 3 years so that Oakland has that championship parade for themselves and they don't have to celebrate the Las Vegas Raiders doing it. But for Los Angeles, this is the most embarrassing thing ever, and it serves the NFL right. They were so greedy. They were so myopic. They were so small-minded and short-sighted. To put two teams there, they get everything they deserve, and it's so embarrassing, the attendance and the interest in L.A. football right now.
Well, how about more people at the USC-Texas game than the Charger game and Ram game combined? I mean, that's horrific. And the Chargers didn't even sell out that. Well, they sold it out, their corporate seats and things like that. That's a bad number. But they didn't even fill up the little soccer stadium in Carson. That's really bad. And the people that were there were Dolphin fans. That's really bad.
It was humiliating, and I really hope, and I'm guessing that the NFL is totally ashamed of what is happening right now, because they're supposed to be the big bad product, and in Los Angeles, you've got two teams that basically nobody cares about, but one team that is totally being ignored. And I think when you talk about how bad this attendance is, this was startling that this weekend, yesterday, there were three games of teams that were both 20 games under 500 in baseball. You had the Mets and the Braves playing in Atlanta. You had the A's were on the road in Philadelphia, and then the White Sox were in Detroit. All six of those teams are 20 games under 500, totally out of it. All three of those games drew more than that Chargers game. Man. I mean, that is totally offensive. I mean, this L.A. thing is just such a joke.
I wish it could fix it. I wish it was something they could do to fix it before it actually happens, because even the players don't like it. I mean, you could just see the comments of Phillip Rivers, who was a Tennessee Valley guy, and some of the others, you know, talking about how they could tell the support. They didn't realize what the cheering was for when the kid missed the field goal to win the game, and they realized that they were cheering because the Dolphins had won the game, and that's why the crowd was cheering, because the Dolphins had won the game. How nuts is that?
It's a total clown show. They also set off the cannon after he missed the kick, as though I'm thinking that they thought the Chargers had won and maybe didn't see the kick go through, but like, that's supposed to be the Charger celebration. He misses the kick and the fans are screaming and the cannon's going off. I mean, this is a total carnival that the NFL has created with this thing.
Damon Amendola, CBS Sports Radio. All right, I can hear you're on the streets of New York. There's got to be a certain buzz there, not just talking about the Yankees and the way they've been playing, but the New York Giants tonight, Monday Night Football taking place at MetLife Stadium. The Detroit Lions come in. Both these teams got to be emboldened by what happened at with the Cowboys in the NFC East and the Packers in the NFC North. You know, the Lions with a chance to grab an early lead if they can get to 2-0. The Giants can pull even at 1-1, as are the Eagles, Cowboys, and Redskins. And I think that's the way that NFC East is going to be all season long. I pulled the Cowboys at 9-7 to start the season, and I think that division could be from 9-7 to 7-9. But really a big early game tonight for both these teams.
Giants can't afford to go 0-2, man. 0-2 is such a death knell in the NFL.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of there's a lot of urgency for the Giants tonight. A lot of talk about how bad the offensive line was. And they're going to be celebrating the 10th anniversary of that 07 Giants Super Bowl team. That was the one that knocked off the undefeated Patriots in the Super Bowl. And I just had Lawrence Tynes, a good friend of mine back from our Kansas City days. He was a kicker for the Chiefs, and that's where I was hosting. And so we became friends there. He's in town with this 07 team, the 10th anniversary. And, you know, he was even saying, boy, you know, rarely do you get pressure on a team in week two, but it kind of feels like you're at home, national TV, Monday night, you're coming off an embarrassing loss opening night, and you kind of got to get it right. So there's definitely some feeling of, well, the Giants need to perform well tonight to avoid that stench or to wash off that stench from the opening Sunday night, no doubt.
Yeah, no question about it. So we'll see what happens with that one tonight, of course. Monday Night Football, the Giants and the Detroit Lions. And the Lions, look, you know, like I say, looking to get to 2-0. And, you know, Aaron Rodgers said, look, we can beat anybody in our building. I don't know if I want to come back here again. You know, if that was a preview last night of the NFC Championship. But, you know, the Vikings also at 1-1 and huge questions about their quarterback situation with Sam Bradford, which seemed to be inevitable. The Bears don't look any good, but, you know, for the Lions, it's a good opportunity to make a move with Matt Stafford and that crew, which are like roaches. They're never dead. I mean, they just keep coming back. If they're within a score or two in the fourth quarter, you're in trouble.
I was really impressed yesterday with the Atlanta Falcons last night, because I really assumed that it was going to be hard for them this season to emotionally get up for all of these games, knowing what had been blown last February. And week one, it certainly looked like that. And then last night, they looked like the best team in the NFC. And they just did total work on the Packers defense and looked like, you know what, if they have home field advantage again through the playoffs in Atlanta, it's going to be hard to defend them. So I was really impressed with what they brought to the table last night. But you know that there's always that in the back of your mind. Are they going to go through some adversity and regret every day letting that thing get away from them last year? So I think the NFC, look, I think right now the NFL is obviously very wide open on both sides, but the NFC certainly, the Falcons made a statement last night, but you can make an argument. There's another six to eight teams that you could just throw and jumbled up in a hat and pick out of a hat of who 2 through 9 would be in the NFC.
Well, I don't know if you saw, boxing judge Adelaide Byrd actually gave that game to the Packers last night. I mean, she said, you know, look, her view, I mean, clearly the Packers were the better team, you know, in that deal last night. So that's a whole other conversation. Stop doing anything else in the fall. I could have spent the whole show on Alvarez and Triple G if that was in the spring. Can't do that now. You know what I mean? You can't do that over a football weekend. They just got to stop everything else when we've got this football season going on. But hopefully the rematch will be in the spring, and we'll spend a lot more time on it then.
Yeah, and, you know, it was such weird timing because coming off of Mayweather-McGregor, we had just had this kind of huge event. And then a month later, we're into Triple G and Alvarez. It just felt, whoa, that's too soon to have another big event fight. And the fight, for the most part, lived up to its end of the bargain, yeah. But the decision was so unsatisfying. But we need some space now. As you said, it's all football right now. We need some space before you have a big boxing match. And that's why Cinco de Mayo is the perfect time to do it in the spring, early summer. But having it on a football weekend is ridiculous.
Yeah, I know. It's tough. It makes it tough. All right, man. Appreciate you as always. Damon Amendola, 9 to noon Eastern time, CBS Sports Radio. If you don't get it, you can always hit the CBS Sports Radio app. It's unbelievable. You can check that out. And also, of course, Sunday morning football, which you hear right here and on all the CBS stations as well. Thanks, D.A. Appreciate you, man.
You got it, big dog. Talk to you later.
All right, thank you. It's Damon Amendola joining us from the streets of Manhattan. I mean, that's pretty clear. All right, we'll get a break in here. When we come back, Cole Kublik is up next. It's the Tom Abraham Show right here on 730, 1039. We're starting to get into games in the SEC that help us start developing a narrative of what it will look like, especially in the East. Well, I say especially in East and West as well. We've seen these types of games. Kentucky and South Carolina was one of those games where one team or the other would come out of this with a little better feel for where they're at and an undefeated record. It was Kentucky getting the win 23-13. Cole Kublik was on the sideline for that one, and he'll get another look at Kentucky, this time at home, as they'll take on Florida coming off of that scintillating win against Tennessee. And this is going to be a very important game in the SEC East as well. And Cole joins us now on the Woody Anderson Ford VIP Hotline. Cole, welcome in. How are you, man?
Hey, doing well, Tom. Thanks.
So you get an up-close personal look at this South Carolina-Kentucky deal. And, you know, Kentucky, a game that from a statistical standpoint is a near dead even. But Kentucky goes in there and gets a win in a really tough scenario. And you got to wonder about Mark Stoops and what they're building there and whether or not they may be the team that could come out of what looks like a jumbled SEC East.
Well, I don't know if I'm ready to say that they're the team that can come out and represent the East in Atlanta, but what a performance. I mean, you give up a 70-plus yard slant to Deebo Samuel on the first play of the game to go for a touchdown, and that stadium was as loud as I've heard an SEC stadium in a long time. The place was sold out. They've got a new entry, a new intro video. They've got pyro flames coming out when the kids come out, 2001 Space Odyssey jamming. That place was rocking. It was a blackout. And you see that ball go, and you're thinking, oh, boy, this thing might get out of hand. And I talked in the open about Kentucky and their game plan, and the key for me was for them to stay patient. Weather the storm. Stay patient with their game plan, stay patient with the running game, stay patient with Benny Snell. And I thought they did it. And it helped that Steven Johnson was phenomenal on third down. Had a couple of huge third down completions, a couple of big third down runs. And Will Muschamp talked to us about that in the meetings, just that how efficient Steven Johnson was with his legs on third down. And I just think he's a perfect example of a guy that's not going to wow you with anything that he does physically. His size, his speed, his arm, none of that's going to wow you, but he's a kid that just understands the system, how to manipulate it, how to work it, how to operate it. And like Coach Stoops told me after the game, he's a winner. The kid understands how to win, and I think that they've got their defense playing fundamentally sound ball. They're pounding the football on the ground. You're seeing the depth that they played on the offensive line a year ago really pay off for them now. I mean, some of the kids that they're having to play got meaningful reps a year ago, and I don't know if they're able to really hold on and stay successful the way that they are if those guys didn't play the reps that they did last season. And this is a team that's going to be a problem. They really change the pace of the game. They give you a different type of a defense that you don't often see. They can change it up and go light, go heavy. And they just got – it's one of the reasons that I like them to surprise some people, Tom. They got a bunch of dudes on both sides of the ball that have played a lot of college football. And that goes a long way.
Yeah, and it seems like – I felt like they kind of won that game on defense as well. I mean, in the fourth quarter, they get the stop. You know, they're hanging on to a lead. It looks like South Carolina is going to climb back into that game. And then they get stoned. And then South Carolina misses that short field goal, the 42-yard field goal. They miss that thing. And then at that point in time, you know, Kentucky takes that ball and goes right down the field and gets 3 points of their own. So all of a sudden it goes from being maybe a 17-13 type of feel, 26 game over. And that's the thing that gets me a little bit juiced about what Kentucky's doing is the way they're playing defense.
Yeah, and I think you could tell after that first throw with just how Jake Bentley looked for the next quarter and a half, two quarters. He kind of came back alive late in the third and began to make some throws and began to make some plays, and the scat route really began to come open for them, and that was something that started to be productive, but it was just too little too late. Honestly, Kentucky was able to sit back in two and three deep at that point in time and just say, we're going to make you work your way back in this. We don't think you have enough time to do it. But they really made him look uncomfortable, and this team is not just Deebo Samuel. Now, his six touchdowns have been huge. That's 6 of the 11 South Carolina have scored, but Brian Edwards is a big play receiver. Hayden Hurst is a big play tight end. They got a couple backs that are really nice out of the backfield, and they just couldn't find a way to get comfortable and consistent and get it going on offense. So I think you're right. Coach Stoops was overly confident when I spoke to him on the field before the game about how his defense was playing, how they were playing assignment football, how they were taking up their gaps. They were in the right place at the right time. And he said, you know what, Cole? We're not going to get pushed around. I know that. I go into this game knowing we will not be pushed around. And that confidence showed in how his group played.
Yeah, and then he gets a Florida team at home in his building. Another critical game now here. Florida with the miraculous victory over Tennessee in a game that was going to go into overtime anyway. So it's not like they snatched victory from the jaws of defeat. They were, you know, they still had opportunity to win that game in overtime. It wasn't supposed to end like that at that particular point in time. You can talk all you want about the just totally botched up coaching job by Tennessee once again. I mean, they just snatched defeat from the jaws of victory more than any other team going. But this is a Florida team that's still struggling on offense, regardless of the 168 yards of rushing that they had against Tennessee. They're still struggling offensively. And if Styles make a fight, this kind of sets up well for Kentucky, I think.
No, it does, because, you know, their team, I think if Florida were to be a team right now based on their personnel that was going to give you problems, it would be by their athleticism. And Kentucky has some linebackers who can really run. Kentucky has some guys on the back end, Jefferson, Westry, who can really run, who can make plays. Now, I think if they had Denzel Ware, I'd feel a lot better about this. I don't expect him to be back. But this is a Kentucky defense that's pretty athletic outside of their front three or four. Now, their bigger guys inside are not super athletic, but I don't know if you have to be that with the way this offensive line's playing and the way the passing game is going for Florida. So you'll see some press man. You'll see some man from Kentucky. They're going to come up, probably challenge those receivers. They'll allow them to take some shots, but probably going to try and take away the quick throws and let speedy receivers go make plays. And then on the flip side of that, you know, it's a defense that's given up some yards on the ground. I mean, Michigan had some success running the football. Tennessee had success running the football, and Benny Snell's one of the 7,000-yard rushers returning in this league, and they'll put him in Wildcat. They'll run power. They'll run counter. They'll line him up in the backfield. They'll have a couple Q runs in there. They'll switch up the Wildcat some. But Kentucky's going to try to go right at this defense. They will be challenged. And if they can get it to the fourth quarter, then I think Kentucky has the advantage in this game, because Florida is pretty good up front. Taven Bryan, Kari Clark, CeCe Jefferson, those guys are good defensive linemen, but they don't have any depth there. And they don't have depth at linebacker. And if Kentucky's in a position where they can lean on this team with 5.5 minutes remaining with a 3 or 7 point lead, that's exactly where Eddie Graham would want that offense to be.
Yeah, I mean, John Kelly ran the ball against that team for 141 yards on just 19 carries. I mean, yeah, that's a smooth 0.4 yards per carry. I mean, as a team, they were around 6 yards a carry. If you take the sacks off, they were around 6 yards a carry, Tennessee against Florida. You just don't usually see those kind of numbers against Florida. So to that point, just your thought on Tennessee, Florida. Let me say it again. John Kelly averaged 7.4 yards per carry. You got first and goal, 2 feet from the end zone. How is it that you don't have all the big uglies put their hand in the dirt and you don't just jack it in there, put the quarterback under center 3 times if you have to? You probably don't have to, but 3 times if you have to, so you don't have all these other things going on that could lead to guys jumping or interference or this or that or whatever other kind of problems, and then eventually an interception. How is it that you just don't line up and pound that ball in? What is the thought process there?
There isn't one. You're not thinking. I mean, it's complete and utter disrespect to your offensive line and your tailback. I mean, I'm going behind right guard 4 consecutive plays there because I think he's the best offensive lineman they have. So I know he's a true freshman. I know he's young, but he's the only guy who's moving people around. I try to find an ace block, a combo with the center and right guard where we can get a little bit of movement, and I'm sitting John Kelly right behind those guys 4 consecutive plays. To not do it one play out of 4, inexcusable.
Yeah. And Kelly runs like his hair's on fire. You know what I mean? Even if you just give him a little seam, he will fight and battle and squeeze and somehow get in there. It's mind boggling. And then, I mean, there were multiple things that they do in that game. It felt like that they should have been winning that game by 10 points at least. And then at the end, you know, to say, well, you know, we were out of defensive backs, you know, so you can't play deeper than the deepest. I mean, really? You're out of defensive backs, so you get beat 20 yards into a route on the last play of the game, the guy's running by your guy. I don't know, man. I don't know how Butch Jones could possibly save this thing. I mean, this is 5 years of undercoaching some really good talent. I just don't see how, I don't know how he can survive this.
Oh, he'll survive this. It's going to be dependent on what happens moving forward.
I mean, at the end of the season, you know.
He still has what I believe to be a pretty good South Carolina team. Vanderbilt's an undefeated team. They got to play them. They got to play a team in LSU that's got more talent than they do. They got to play the number one team in the nation in Alabama. They got to play Kentucky, who's undefeated right now. So all of a sudden we knew – I mean, the reason that I picked Tennessee to finish 4th in the East was because of the schedule, and the schedule looks more difficult than it did going into the season right now based on the way they've played also. So – he'll be fine now, but it's going to be dependent on what happens the rest of the way, and that stretch looks daunting.
No question about it. Cole Kubelik with us, sideline analyst for the SEC Network. This one, Monday's our sideline analyst day. Tom Luganville and Cole Kubelik every Monday. It doesn't really get any better than that. If CBS had it to do over again, and I know that they've got to get everybody in over some period of time and so on, so that's probably why they're going to Nashville. Not that Vanderbilt isn't impressive what they did defensively. They actually called that one, but I thought that was very impressive what they did to a K-State team that was averaging 55 points a game coming in there. But if you had to do it over again, I mean, Georgia-Mississippi State looks really salty right now, doesn't it? I mean, we want to know about Georgia. Is this real? Is there a team that's head and shoulders above the rest of the East? And State coming off a 30-point beatdown of LSU. It's almost like they need this game now to verify what we just saw in the last game, you know, that type of thing. This one ought to be a great game.
I agree, and I mean, Grantham's got a little bit of revenge that he's going to want to get on Athens, and that might play into it emotionally some, but I kind of disagree. I think CBS got it right.
Really?
Because when are you going to get Vanderbilt meaning as much as they do right now? I mean, they've given up 13 points all season. Kyle Shermer he's the number one passer efficiency-wise in the SEC. There are a lot of bragging points about Vanderbilt right now. I mean, coming off of an AP top 20 win, you're not going to be able to say these things and sell this team, I don't think, the way you are now, maybe not at any other point in the season. If you get them after Alabama, they might be a totally different team. Now, am I saying that I think Vanderbilt truly competes for 4 quarters with Alabama? Probably not. There are some things I think they can do to cause problems. But listen, that Georgia-Mississippi State game is going to be great. I get it. I'm not buying Georgia yet because I think the Notre Dame win is a perception win, just like the USC win over Texas is a perception win. We're all celebrating those wins like they're these monumental, gigantic college football wins and program-changing wins, and they're just not. So I do think the Mississippi State-Georgia is good, and I think it's going to be a great game. But I think right now, if you're going to take Vanderbilt at some point in time, Alabama's always going to rate, no matter what. They're going to bring that number.
Yeah.
And I think now's the time to go get Vanderbilt, because you can potentially sell that this is going to be a very competitive game.
Yeah, no, it's that's what I'm saying. I think the deal is that you got to get Vandy in. They're contracted to get everybody in, so you got to get Vandy in. So this is the best spot. And you're right, they drag the Alabama crowd with them. But State Georgia
I checked on that. And I need to double check this, because yeah. I talked to somebody this weekend that said they're not contractually obligated to get every team every year.
No,
I had always heard that they were. So yeah. I need to double
it's check not every that. Year. It's every 2 years. Everybody has to appear at least once every 2 years. From my CBS guy, that's what he told me. Oh, that's a good point. I'll double check that. I'll see what the rule is. There is some rule that they have there. It's not every year, though. You're right. It's definitely right. Not every year. I mean, there's years you get six or seven times at, you know, Alabama, Auburn, over and over again. So,
There's a five-game limit for a team. They can only have one team five times, but I don't think they have to have every team on the schedule.
In fairness to the Georgia win versus the USC win, I mean, USC was a 17-point favorite over Texas. Georgia was a 4-point dog at Notre Dame, who then turned around and went on the road and scored 49 points against Boston College. Now, I know it's Boston College, but at least it's an ACC team. I don't hate Georgia. I think USC is way over their skis. I think the perception of USC is out of control right now. They have done nothing because Stanford's not that good. Tom Luganville said it, and he's a USC honk. You know, Stanford turns out they're not really all that good. So how good is that win? I think USC. But the problem is, then who's that leave out there? Washington? I think that's all there is. Yeah. UCLA gets whacked. UCLA is terrible defensively. I think Washington and nobody else out west.
No, I think this, you know, it's Oklahoma or bust in the Pac-12. Oklahoma State looks maybe more real than we thought. I thought the Big 12 was going to get left out. And if I could reassemble it now, I would say the Pac-12 is getting left out, because that the conference has taken too many hits. I mean, Stanford just lost to a Mountain West team. Granted, it's a pretty good Mountain West team who's defeated two Pac-12 teams, by the way, this year in San Diego State. So that conference is just not good. I mean, obviously an ugly loss to start the season, losing to Colorado State. I think that conference is going to – Washington's going to have to be – or USC are going to have to be undefeated to get in. Well, of course, USC could lose one. Everybody's wishful thinking of them just being better than they are and probably still get in, but I don't know if they would really deserve it.
All right, Cole Kubelik with us. By the way, College Press Box, which is a wonderful site for those of us in the media to be able to, you know, get numbers and get information quickly, has that Cole was on the Auburn-Mercer game and – the South Carolina Kentucky game. I'm pretty sure that didn't happen. I'm just saying, I saw good chunks of both games, and I'm just saying that Cole wasn't on both games. But having said Cole.
Luganville's pulled a doubleheader before. I haven't been fortunate enough to be able to pull that off just yet. So maybe one day.
Those might have been a little too close to each other. I'm not sure. Although you probably could have made it. You never know. You're supposed to be leaving the Mercer Auburn game at halftime, because that thing should have been well in the hopper and turned into a JV game by the second half. It doesn't, and I know Auburn had 510 yards, and Stidham's numbers look wonderful. 32 of 37 against air is a good thing to do, no question about it. But, my God, that's a 17-10 game in the fourth quarter. People kept texting, tweeting me, I know turnovers. The coach's response to me is always, that's focus and concentration. What's the player's response? What's with five turnovers against Mercer when you're supposed to put that away on homecoming?
No, it's unacceptable. You just got to clean it up. It's something that ball security needs to become a point of emphasis again in practice this week for the Auburn Tigers, and something that can't happen. I think the bigger question for me, which those are huge, turnovers are going to cost you games. But I think the bigger question for me is, why are there no other tailbacks that are emerging? I mean,
is Cam Martin hurt? Is he hurt? Do you know? I don't know what's going on. Where did Cam Martin go? He had 133 yards in the first game. Hasn't been on the field since. Do you know? Is he hurt or something?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
But I mean, when you look down the list and you see non-quarterback runs the past 2 weeks, and Eli Stove has one, Chandler Cox has one, and Cam Pett 56, and that's it. Those are your rushing numbers outside of QB runs, which most of those are sacks anyway. I don't understand. No offense should be managed that way. I don't care if it's Trent Richardson or Darren McFadden, or you can't manage a kid that way.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why I don't understand what happened with Martin, because he looked good and he showed some, you know, certainly showed some giddy up in that first game. All right, the big story obviously coming out of Auburn is the dismissal of Shaun White. I'm a Shaun White fan because I know his coach, and he's everything I've known about the kid since I watched him play in high school in Florida is that this is a good guy. It's a decent guy. The players love him and so on. The guy did not get thrown off the team for public intoxication. I mean, there's no excuse for public intoxication, but that's not what got him thrown off the team. This is obviously something that has been building, but just seems like a really odd scenario. I actually thought he'd play some this week because I thought they'd have the game in hand and we'd get to see him some. But what's your take on this whole thing and how the Shaun White era ends with such an ugly scene really at the end of his career for Auburn?
It's disappointing. And, you know, I don't know Shaun personally, but I know a lot about the situation. And if there's an issue there with him, I think the most important thing is for him to get that situated and to get that taken care of. And I mean, I can speak from experience, somebody who's battled substance abuse. It's just, there's not enough people when you're there, when you're doing that have their eyes open to the fact that it could be a legitimate problem. I think there's too many people that are, oh, he's a college athlete. He's in college. He's living the college life. He's doing what normal college kids do. And if he does have an issue, he might not learn that until he's 30, 35, 38 years old. And that's unfortunate. That's just based on my experience. So I hope, no matter what, that Shaun White gets his life together if he does have a problem, if he does have an issue. And I agree with you. There's not a college football player in America that's been kicked off the team for getting arrested for public intox. But the repeat offenses begin to mount. And you begin to have less leeway, and less forgiveness the more times that you get in trouble. Even if all the violations are minor, you become a headache and you become a guy that is just not worth the risk. It's not worth having you around because you are viewed as a detriment to your team. My assumption would be that that's the case with Shaun White, and I hate it for him. I hate it for the football team because, like you said, I think he could help this team. This is a team right there with Kentucky that I said going into the season from a quarterback depth perspective was probably in better shape than anybody else in the league. So you had two guys with SEC starting ability and experience, really Power 5 starting experience. So it's unfortunate. I hope he can play football again. But more importantly, I hope he gets his life together and you know, can do positive things moving forward.
Yeah, I think you wrap your arms around that guy and you kind of help him get through this, and it's in the locker room, helps him get through it and stuff like that. You don't kick him to the curb. So that's why I think there's something else deeper than all of this that is involved in all of this. And I don't know. We'll just see. Well, for his sake, I hope the best. And then for Auburn's sake, I mean, I know they like the kid, the freshman, Malik Willis. He's done a lot of nice things, but a spot that was a position of strength, you know, now with a little bit of a shaky start from Stidham, does not look nearly as good as it was. And but that's just bigger than football, obviously, you know, when you have something like this. All right, great game you got this week, man. I mean, this is going to be a really good one on Saturday night. I think this is a very intriguing game. Kentucky and Florida are going to mean a lot to the East and a lot to the SEC. So it's good stuff, and good luck with that one.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, thank you. It's Cole Kubelin. All right, Scooterbury. Come back with an update. Rocking and rolling here on a Reaction Monday. Top of the hour, wide open lines for an entire segment. So get ready to react there. Can't wait to hear from Tennessee fan. Can't wait to hear from Auburn fan. Alabama fan, if you want to weigh in. Vandy fan, if you want to get in, if you're such a thing.
When you come to our house, we show you how to play some SEC ball.
Yeah, there you go. We'll be back. 7:30, 103.9 AM.
We had to practice harder. We had to come out and play harder. And I think we did all three of those from last week to this week. And really pleased with how our guys came out, took on the challenge, playing an extremely talented LSU team. And, you know, obviously I think the environment had a lot to do with it.
Yeah, you should feel good about that. That's Dan Mullen, Mississippi State coach. Let's get an update with T-Mac. It's a Doghouse Sports Report.
A little NFL injury update for you, Big Dog. The 2016 sack leader Vic Beasley for the Falcons will miss a month due to a hamstring injury suffered in a Sunday night victory over the Packers. Great win, great football game for the Falcons there. The Carolina Panthers tight end Greg Olsen is out six to eight weeks after having surgery on a broken foot. Browns wide receiver Corey Coleman has confirmed today that he has broken his right hand on Sunday and will undergo surgery. It's the same
second
hand,
year in a row.
Yep, yeah. Same hand he broke a season ago that caused him to miss six games. Odell Beckham Jr. will also be a game-time decision tonight for Monday Night Football with an ankle injury. And, I just looked. I can't find exactly what's wrong with Gronk, so you have to forgive me not having exactly if he'll miss or how long he will be. But Andrew Luck is confirmed to be out this week versus the Browns, so there you go. The Browns probably have a pretty good shot to beat them as well. And the NFL's emergency stay request in the Ezekiel Elliott case has been denied. This means Zeke is allowed to continue playing with his case, or playing while his case is moved through the courts. The case
you mean
now
quitting or actual playing in the game? Is he going to just quit? I mean, that's what he did, against Denver.
Well, he's allowed to play. Whether he will actually try is up to him. The case now moves to the Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans, where the NFL has already filed an appeal. I'm Tony Mack, and that is your Doghouse Sports Report.
Speaking of injuries, Tennessee getting whacked again. Todd Kelly Jr. Apparently out indefinitely, maybe out for the year. Of course they had already lost Juwan Jennings, and they just keep getting guys whacked. I mean, it's a mess there. Just a mess there. I mean, I don't know what other way to say it. It's a mess. By the way, he was asked, Butch Jones, about Jarek Guarantano getting a look. And his answer was, the QB is always a byproduct of the individuals around him. We had too many errors around him, meaning Quentin Dormady. Dormady cannot compile mistakes. One missed assignment or read cannot be overcome by trying too hard on the next play. I don't even know what he's talking about. He was happy that all of the players were in the building yesterday, which is great to see, he said. All their focus is now on UMass. UMass, all right. I get geared up for UMass. All right, phone lines are open. Now, go ahead and get in. 866-485-9867. I'm taking your calls next. Right after the band clears the field right here on 730-1039. Yep.